Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A choir opened today's state funeral mass for victims of Monday's earthquake in central Italy. 205 wooden coffins, some of them tiny white caskets of children placed on top of those of their parents, were laid out in a courtyard in L'Aquila, one of the worst-hit towns. The service was held outdoors because so many churches were damaged in the quake. Joining us on the line is Rachel Donadio, who's covering this story for the New York Times. And Rachel, I understand that Italy came to a standstill for this service today. Can you describe what it was like?
Well, they declared a national day of mourning today, Friday, for the earthquake victims. The funeral was held in a police academy. It was an extremely emotional and moving and really very sad funeral service. One of the most devastating images I saw during this funeral was an entire family, four young sisters, lined up in coffins one by one with their first names and the years in which they were born. There was Rosa, 1992, Michela, 1995, Chiara, 1998, and Giuseppina, 2002. On top of each, there were large bunches of white lilies wrapped in cellophane with a ribbon on top reading, "From Papa."
We've read that special dispensation was given by the Vatican for this mass on the Good Friday holiday, a day that Catholics, probably the only day in the calendar year that Catholics don't celebrate mass, and the Vatican's second-in-command priest was there. Is that right?
That's correct. That added, I believe, to the emotion of the day. Good Friday is the only day in which mass is not celebrated. It's very, very rare for the Vatican to grant such a dispensation. But this being Easter weekend, and Good Friday celebrates the day of in which Jesus was crucified just before Easter, all the priests were wearing their purple robes, which are worn for Easter and for funerals. It was very moving, and indeed, the Pope himself sent his personal secretary to deliver the opening remarks, and the Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertone, delivered the homily. It was a very moving homily in which he talked about people, you know, wondering what had happened and looking for meaning, and many, many people were just weeping throughout the whole thing.
Hmm. You know, you quote one woman in one of your stories as saying that she wants to leave Italy because of all this pain. Do you think that a lot of people there feel that way?
Well, I think in some ways, this one woman I spoke to was just so stricken with grief because her downstairs neighbors, an entire family, a husband, a pregnant wife, and their two-year-old child died. I think she was particularly grief-stricken. I think there's also a lot of local solidarity. People are trying to rally around, and it kind of brings out a local and regional pride. That being said, there is a tremendous amount of destruction here. It is very hard to convey. Historic center flattened. Businesses flattened, hospitals, university, the city offices, everyone's business. It's very hard to know, even once you start figuring out which buildings can be saved and which can't, what are these people going to do for work? What are they going to do to earn money? Where are they going to live? There are these tent cities that have been set up that now have 17,000 people. That's a lot of people living in tents, and the tents aren't going to, you know, they're hot in the summer and cold in the winter, and they're not a permanent solution. So now was a day of mourning, but next comes, how do we rebuild, where do we rebuild, and what's the next chapter?
Mm. We read that two more bodies were found overnight, and the total number of those killed in this earthquake is now 289 people. Are there still search efforts underway?
There are search efforts underway. They were said to continue until Easter, so there are a few more days left. But at this point, I think many people fear that, you know, they're looking for bodies, not survivors.
Hmm. I do understand, though, that despite this devastation, that businesses started to open yesterday, bakeries and butcher shops. There's some attempt, anyway, to try to get things to get back to normal.
That's right. Some small businesses have been opening. There are some supermarkets further around town that have been opening. But I was also reading reports of black marketeering, of people selling, you know, milk for 20 euros a gallon and the like. I think that's something that will calm down once stores do open. But one thing to bear in mind is L'Aquila is a small town with a historic center and a lot of little villages surrounding it that are all part of L'Aquila. So if one town has been devastated, another town might have stores that are still open. But it's a very big area, and there are a lot of local roads, and a lot of them are closed, so it's rather hard to navigate.
Rachel Donadio, a New York Times correspondent who joined us from L'Aquila, Italy, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
While many U.S. workers had to put off retirement this year because of the down markets, some retirement benefit plans are more stable. Even if a company goes bankrupt, these pension plans, defined benefit pensions, are federally insured. But a recent Boston Globe report says the agency that insures those pensions might need a bailout. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, or PBGC, lost billions of dollars after its former director changed the agency's investment strategy and put much of its portfolio into stocks. Also, the agency may have to back up the retirement plans for auto workers, which could cost about $13 billion more dollars. Joining us to talk about this is Olivia Mitchell. She's executive director of the Pension Research Council at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business. And Professor Mitchell, why did the PBGC change its investment strategy? Smart move?
Many people in my field, in the pension field, see that as a somewhat risky strategy. And I think if you owe a flow of income, a stream of income to retirees, then back it with a steady, stable type of asset and don't try to gamble.
Now we understand that the PBGC has put about $64 billion into stocks. Do we know what this has done to its fund?
The PBGC is somewhat reluctant to report results. It does so mainly once a year in its annual report, and it has not reported anything much new since September last year. Of course, what we do know is that it was underfunded as of last fall by about $11 billion. It's probably much more underfunded at the moment. But that is actually not the biggest part of the problem. The big concern people are pointing to is what happens if some of the auto companies go bankrupt. There's substantially greater underfunding there, and that could be a real problem.
How could the agency survive such a hit if we're talking about the auto giants, you know, going into bankruptcy and then the PBGC having to take over for the pensions or the guaranteed benefits of the workers in the auto industry, and it already has this shortfall?
Even without GM or any of the other auto-related companies going bust, the PBGC was already short. Now, what's interesting about this entity is that it does not have the full faith and credit of the U.S. government backing it. In other words, nobody really knows what will happen on the day the checks have to stop for fear of running short. It's quite possible this is another one of these too-big-to-fail agencies like Freddie and Fannie that we've read about recently, in which case I think the taxpayers should start to feel a hand in their pocket.
So that means bailout, again, from Congress for the PBGC.
I think that that's a very real possibility. Now, there may be some sharing of the pain. Currently, pension benefits are guaranteed by the PBGC only up to a cap. So, for example, in 2009, if you retired at age 65, the most you would get under the rules is $4,500 a month from the PBGC, even if your benefit was supposed to be higher. So it may be that that cap is lowered. It may be that other the premiums are raised. But it's quite plausible to argue that the overhang of underfunding in the corporate sector is on the order of about $500 billion.
We've talked with some companies about this problem and about the whole pension issue. One company in particular said that it may not be able to continue with a defined benefit plan.
It's certainly the case that many corporate pension plans themselves have invested heavily in equity and private equity and emerging markets and alternatives and so forth, hoping against hope that they could make money with these somewhat riskier assets. The problem with that strategy is that you have to pay your retirees every year. And yet on the asset side, they're taking very risky investments, hoping to make money. If they don't, then they'll put the plan to the government. So I think it is a bit of a gamble. And unfortunately, we're in a worst case scenario now.
We also should say, once again, that we are talking about corporate-defined benefit plans, but we also have public-defined benefit plans as well, and public employees, and those funds are not insured by the PBGC. But, you know, we recently spoke with someone about the public pension plans who said that those are facing a $1 trillion shortfall. So what happens if those go insolvent?
Well, public sector pensions would include the teachers, the judges, the police, the firefighters, all those people that work for public sector governments. These plans have also invested heavily in equities and alternatives and so forth. They started out less well-funded, and they are in much worse shape now than the corporate plans. The big unknown is what will happen if they go bust. Now, typically, we have seen many states take the position that the defined benefit promises are guaranteed by the full faith and credit of the state constitutions. So if that's true, then once again, taxpayers in the state may be asked to pony up to be able to meet those obligations. Hmm.
We heard from some folks in Cincinnati where they said their fund is running short, and they might have to shut down a lot of services in the city just to keep the pension fund solvent. Do you think we're going to be hearing a lot more stories like that?
I believe that pension envy is going to become a much bigger political issue, especially in the public sector, because people, perhaps without being very well informed, perceive public sector employees as being relatively high paid and having nice benefits. And yet the pothole out in front of my house doesn't get filled. And so I think this will cause increasing strife across different sectors of society. Now, having said that, we have to recognize something like a quarter of public sector employees are not actually covered by Social Security. So, yes, they may have a somewhat higher pension, but they're not getting. That's to offset what they're not getting from Social Security.
So overall, I mean, it sounds as if the system has to change, regardless if we're talking about public pensions or private pensions. Are we going to see some positive change in all of this, or can we just at this point look at it and say we're really in a bind here and just hope we can sail through it as smoothly as possible?
Well, I think what people realize now is that defined benefit plans were not a secure promise. When I offer to pay you some compensation at 20, 30, 40, 50 years in the future, there's going to be risk associated with my being able to make good on that long-term commitment. And now what we see is those risks coming home to roost. The employers are going bankrupt. The pensions are not, I think, adequately funded or invested. And the backstop agency, the PBGC, may not be there for us. I think this is going to change the way workers see the nature of their compensation. They're probably going to be a lot more interested in getting it now and perhaps saving it on their own than confiding in an employer that may or may not be here 50 years from now.
Well, Olivia Mitchell, Executive Director of the Pension Research Council at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Just ahead, a consultant who advises companies about pensions, he says defined benefit plans and not 401ks could actually help some businesses. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about retirement. This year, many Americans had to put off retirement because their savings dwindled when the markets collapsed. And we've been hearing about this concept of a defined benefit pension, where workers are guaranteed a monthly retirement check for life. But that idea is fading fast. In 1980, about 40% of Americans had defined benefit pensions. Today, just 20% do, and more companies are switching from defined pensions to 401k plans. Barry Young has been advising companies on pensions for more than 30 years. He's currently a senior pension actuary with the Principal Financial Group, and he joins us from his office in Atlanta. Welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, 20% of American workers who have these defined pension benefit plans, why are employers offering it when it seems as if it's not a good investment?
Well, first off, it's debatable whether it's a good investment. But the most important answer to that question is to help employees retire. I think it's important that employers maintain a retirement program that allows employees to retire at an age that is good for the employer and good for the employees, and a defined benefit plan does that in a more predictable fashion than any other retirement plan.
Why is that?
It's because the benefit that the employer receives is independent of what happens to the stock market. For example, if a employer only has defined contribution plans, which obviously all but 20% of companies do, and the stock market goes down 40% like it did last year, then a lot of employees will have to defer their retirement 1, 2, 3, or 4 years. And unfortunately, they might defer their retirement just at the time that employers want to reduce their workforce and have people move through the workforce. A defined benefit plan could be a very good investment for a company because it leads to a much more even and predictable pattern of retirement.
So it helps sort of, weed out workers, if you will.
Well, weed them out or lead to people retiring at an age that makes sense. For instance, if you're a heavy manufacturing firm and it makes sense for your employees to retire at 62 because they become less productive or it's just very hard work and they don't have a defined benefit plan, and for that reason employees work till they're 65 or 68, I would argue that that is not very good for the bottom line of that company.
So with so many companies going to 401ks and many companies switching to that option for retirement, it sounds like maybe it's not necessarily a great idea for a lot of companies then. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think long term, a lot of employers will find out it's not a good idea. I think the problem is a lot of companies are primarily focused on the bottom line over the short term. And because of recent changes in the pension funding rules, employees are seeing contributions skyrocket this year. And a lot of them are just going to conclude that they can't handle the level of cost or the volatility of cost associated with a defined benefit pension.
Do we know what it's cost U.S. companies this year, some of those changes?
Well, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, they expect for all the plans that they cover, which are mostly private companies, that the contributions for 2008 will be around $42 billion, and 2009 they expect it to double to $84 billion. So that's a huge increase and a huge liability on American companies. For some companies, it might go up a little bit, and for other companies, instead of just doubling, it could go up 3 or 4 times.
Why have the costs gone up so much? Why have they gone up so dramatically, so quickly?
Well, most employers that have defined benefit plans invest the assets that will eventually be used to pay the benefits out in a combination of stocks and bonds. Since the stock market went down about 40% last year, companies have to make additional contributions to make up for that loss. And under the new rules, the Pension Protection Act, they have to spread that over a very short period of time. So it's to make up for that very large loss in the stock market by making much greater contributions this year. I think a lot of plan sponsors will just give up and freeze and ultimately terminate the plans.
What do you think this means overall? I think for our notion of retirement, do you think it's shifting and that's what we're going through right now?
Oh, I think that's absolutely the case. I think it will result in people working longer. I think it might result in people coming in and out of the workforce. A lot of companies, I hope, will move to what's called phased retirement, where if employees can't afford to fully retire, maybe they let them work half-time or 60% of the time. But I think, to your point, the whole concept of retirement in the U.S. will change dramatically, both for the company and for the employees.
And it's something that has to be done, really.
I think it does. If we go back a few years ago, a lot of experts thought that when the baby boomers retire, American companies won't have enough workers. I don't think we're going to be faced with that problem. I think it's going to be just the opposite, that employees will have to work longer than we all expected, and it'll make it more difficult to refresh the workforce and bring in younger workers.
So not good for either end, really.
It's not, but again, as a pension expert, I would suggest that if companies can ride out this current very difficult period and maintain their defined benefit plans, I think long term they'll find out that it will serve the company very well, in addition to serving the employees very well.
But would you say that it's rare that a defined benefit plan does work out very well for employers? Is it more the exception than the rule?
I think until the last few years, I would say most defined benefit plans worked out very well for plan sponsors. I think the combination of the market decline in 2001 through 2003 and then this very difficult market decline is making the cost level such that it's not working out very well. But everything runs in phases. It's our suggestion that, again, if plan sponsors can ride out this period, if the economy improves and the stock market comes back to reasonable levels, then I think the pension cost levels will come down. And long-term, those employers who keep pension plans, I think, will be glad they did so. But again, I'm afraid a very significant portion of plan sponsors will determine that they just can't handle the cost or the volatility of the cost.
Barry Young advises companies on their pension plans for the Principal Financial Group. He spoke with us from his office in Atlanta. Barry, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Monday on Here and Now, Newsweek's Jonathan Alter wrote one of the definitive books on FDR's first 100 days, and he joins us to assess the first 100 days of Barack Obama's presidency. Also, a look at Postville, Iowa, a year after one of the largest federal immigration raids there. That's Monday, back after the news, Here and Now. Electronic books are making huge strides, with Google scanning millions of books into its digital library and Amazon breaking through with the popular Kindle electronic reader. Amazon recently released a new version of the Kindle that not only allows users to wirelessly download books and other text, but it also reads to you. Both of these developments have publishers running scared and, in some cases, running to court. David Weinberger of Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society joins us with more. And David, first I want to ask, how does the new Kindle stack up to the original?
Doesn't stack up much higher. It has some improvements. So it's a little faster. It holds more books. There's also the ability now for it to read out loud any text, any book, any magazine that's in the Kindle.
Well, you have it in front of us. It's very slim. For folks who don't know, it's really about the size of a small notebook, actually. And what is it going to read to us, David?
Let's just see.
Okay.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness.
Very nice. We have a little Dickens there. I'm wondering, why is this causing controversy? It seems like it would be a great device for folks to be able to hear something read to them.
Sure. I mean, there are lots of uses, from listening in a car to if your vision is impaired. So many people were excited about it. Some authors and publishers were not, because they felt that it was infringing upon the audio rights that they sell separately when they create audio books, CD books.
So lawsuits?
Threats. Amazon stood strong in saying that they absolutely believe that it's legal, it's not infringing. Audiobooks tend to be read by competent readers with a James Earl Jones sort of voice, clearly better than the robotic voice. Eventually, the robotic voices will improve, but because Amazon depends upon the goodwill and the deals that it does with publishers to feed content into the Kindle, they said, well, you know what, we'll let the rights holders decide whether they will allow their books to be read out loud by the robotic voice.
So authors can say that they don't want their work to be read like that, then.
That is
essentially
correct.
And so let's move on to Google. They have already scanned, 7 million books? And book publishers are not so happy about that.
The book publishers and the Authors Guild also were very so upset that they did sue, on the grounds that Google, by scanning the books, was violating their copyright, even though Google maintained they were scanning them, they were indexing them so you could search, but they would only show you snippets of the book. Google initially said that this was not a violation of copyright, but then they engaged in this gigantic 134-page settlement.
So where does it stand then, essentially, right now? What does the settlement mean for people who want to read books online?
For public domain books, books out of copyright, we'll be able to, as readers, read, download any of them online for free.
So how long does a copyright last then?
Right now it lasts 70 years after you die. For books that are in print and we know who the copyright holders are, you'll be able to search them, you'll be able to read chunks of them, depending on how much the publishers let you, and be able to press a button to get them electronically. The big contentious category are books that are under copyright, but we can't find the rights owners because they were written in 1930 and the rights owners is somebody we never heard of and is maybe dead. These are orphaned works, and there are millions and millions of them. They're being scanned now by Google, and the settlement provides a mechanism by which these orphaned works become searchable accessible. The settlement sets up Google as a de facto monopoly on the distribution of electronic versions of books, of the electronic library that we will be dealing with for a generation. In fact, there's even a most favored nation clause, they call it, in the settlement that effectively removes the possibility of competition.
Some folks say that when you're on electronic readers and you're reading things that way, you're basically selecting what you want to read and never sort of getting a richer feel of a variety of issues that you may not have considered otherwise.
This highlights what I think is the biggest shortcoming of Kindle and ebooks like it. Kindle thinks that it's only about reading books that you've bought from Amazon. You can get other stuff in, but it's hard. Once we have ebooks that view themselves more as participating in the network, open to every resource available on the network, including the interactive elements of the network, then these things will be as full of serendipity and distractions as the net itself is.
David Weinberger, a fellow at Harvard's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society, talking with us about the future of electronic books. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Back with more news in just a bit. It's Here and Now. Today is the 11th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which set up the peace process in Northern Ireland. The agreement was supposed to mark the end of the decades-long conflict between Protestants, who wanted Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom, and Catholics, who wanted to unite with the Republic of Ireland to the south. Protestants and Catholics are now sharing power, but recently their fragile peace was marred by new violence. The BBC's political correspondent Nick Childs reports.
A funeral and a focus for cross-community grief in Northern Ireland.
We gather together today to pray Requiem Mass for the repose of the soul of Stephen Carroll, who was killed while serving the citizens of Craigavon on Monday night.
Dissident Republicans opposed to the Northern Ireland peace process said they were behind the killings of police officer Stephen Carroll and two British soldiers 48 hours earlier. David McKittrick is the veteran Northern Ireland correspondent for the Independent newspaper.
People thought that the dissident Republicans had more or less gone away, and it's now obvious that they hadn't. The big question is whether they can mount any kind of sustained campaign or whether the killings that they managed to carry out were a kind of a one-off. So really, we're in the business of testing the strength of these dissidents. We thought they hadn't got very much strength. It turns out that they were more of a menace than we thought. We're now in the business of measuring exactly what threat they posed to the country and to the peace process.
In the aftermath of the killings, the leading Republican, Sinn Féin politician and former IRA commander Martin McGuinness stood literally shoulder to shoulder with his unionist partner in government and the top Northern Ireland police officer to condemn those behind the attacks.
They are traitors to the island of Ireland. They have betrayed the political desires, hopes and aspirations of all of the people who live on this island, and they don't deserve to be supported by anyone.
For David McKittrick, this was a striking image of how Northern Ireland has changed, despite the slow and fitful progress of the peace process.
In the old days, you would have had recriminations, you would have had politicians attacking each other. They used to call it here the politics of the last atrocity. Here we've had atrocities, but now you have the politicians actually united and saying these people will not drive us apart. These people are trying to wreck the process, but we are absolutely determined that it will prevail. And when the politicians came out and said that, there was a huge sense of welcome, a huge sense of relief right across the community that this peace process wasn't going to be brought down and that it had brought a unity that we'd never seen before.
The two main dissident Republican groups are thought to number perhaps only 50 to 80 hardcore members, with maybe 200 to 300 more activists. And their public support seems minimal. Monica McWilliams is the Northern Ireland Human Rights Commissioner and a signatory to the Good Friday Agreement.
I think both the politicians and the people showed leadership at that time. The people took to the streets and the minute silence across the whole of Northern Ireland in all of the main towns was very indicative of the mood of the people that were saying there is no going back.
But it may not be as simple as that. The security services had been warning for some time that the dissident Republicans had been getting more dangerous. And the mainstream Republican leaders in Sinn Féin do have to grapple with a difficult tension in their political strategy. Adherence to the peace process, but also still to the goal of a united Ireland. Dr. Martin Frampton of Cambridge University has studied the history of the Republican movement.
This is the problem for Sinn Féin. How do they both confirm their desire to continue to be part of this and continue to move the peace process forward, which obviously entails, in a sense, them making Northern Ireland work, with their ideological continuity, which suggests they should be wanting to see the breakdown of Northern Ireland, the breakdown of the border, and moves towards United Ireland.
Dr. Frampton says this is a tension that the dissidents can still exploit.
It is clear that within so-called Republican heartlands in various places across Northern Ireland, there has been an ebbing of support, I think, for the Provisional Republican movement, and much of that support has drifted into a kind of broad hinterland, I think, in which the dissidents can operate.
There is also a concern that the veteran dissidents are finding new recruits in the deprived hardline Republican areas among disaffected youths. Margaret Gilmore studies Northern Ireland security issues for the Royal United Services Institute in London.
Just like there's an underclass in other cities in the UK, in socially deprived areas, who feel that they are disenfranchised and they're not part of society, and maybe they come from dysfunctional families, maybe they will turn to crime in some parts of the UK, and in Northern Ireland there are the paramilitaries waiting to pounce.
And that, says David McKittrick, is exactly what happens.
You have this mixture of godfathers, as we sometimes call them here, and then the youngsters who are prey to them saying, come along with us, son, join our organisation and be a hero and help someday to bring about a united Ireland.
Certainly these youths in the Republican heartland of Derry seem to support the recent attacks.
Has to be done if they want the Brits out.
That shooting last week, plenty of people that think they deserved it, and that cop deserved it.
BBC Radio Ulster. The headlines at 6, the Vistian car parts factory in West Belfast closes with the loss of 200 jobs.
In this context, the economic recession makes for unfortunate timing. Previously, new investment had been seen as a driving force of the peace process. Dr. Martin Frampton.
The economic downturn is not what's behind the recent attacks, but there's no doubt that if the economy does continue to head downwards and things like unemployment grow, this will create a broader constituency which might well be amenable to this dissident Republican message, which says that the status quo is not delivering anything for them.
The dissident Republican strategy is in part to try to provoke a security crackdown, the spectre of a real return to the bad old days. Policing in Northern Ireland has always been sensitive, and still is. But there is a new police force, with broader support than before. Monica McWilliams points to other signs of progress on the law and order front, such as when there were complaints that the suspects in the latest killings had been held too long by the police without charge.
My own commission visited the places of detention, and we said that these need to be appropriate and they need to meet the minimum standards. And again, we need unity around those kinds of issues.
The other spectre has been of a tit-for-tat response by the so-called loyalist paramilitaries. So far, there hasn't been one. Margaret Gilmore believes that, on the contrary, the loyalists may finally be about to follow the main Republican paramilitaries in decommissioning their weapons. And that could open the way to a key further step in the peace process that until now has been a stumbling block, transferring security responsibility from London to Belfast.
Decommissioning, followed by devolution of policing and justice, are really the final pieces in the political jigsaw in Northern Ireland. If both of those things can be achieved this year, then that will be seen as a big result. And I think there was a determination and a will not to rock that boat.
So where does this all leave the international image of the Northern Ireland peace process as a model for others to follow? David McKittrick.
The image has certainly taken a battering, but at the same time, the smoke is clearing now and people are saying, well, what have we got left? Has this caused irreparable damage? And I think the general answer to that is no, it hasn't. It has shown that the peace process has an underlying strength. I think the bottom line is that it showed that our society is not as divided as it once was.
Despite the recent shocks, there remains a mood of cautious optimism in Northern Ireland, that it's a long way still from the bad old days.
That report from the BBC's Nick Childs. Still ahead, music from the up-and-coming Australian brother-sister duo, Angus and Julia Stone. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now.
Wish I had a mango tree in my backyard. You standing next to me, take the picture.
This song is Mango Tree, the opening track on the CD A Book Like This from brother and sister duo Angus and Julia Stone. Their CD went gold in their native Australia, won critical acclaim in Britain, and on these shores they made a splash at this year's South by Southwest Music Festival and shot to number one on the iTunes singer-songwriter chart.
Not a rainy day, you simply don't go outside.
Angus and Julia Stone join us now from the NPR studios in New York City. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hey.
How you going?
Okay, well, we should say that this CD, A Book Like This, is a collaboration of your individual effort. You each sort of do your own songs here and help each other with songs, but you don't write songs together.
No, we don't write songs together, yeah.
So, Angus, I'm wondering, can you explain, how do you describe the difference in your styles, in your musical styles, yours and Julia's?
Julia, all I know is she writes really beautiful, encrypted, deep songs about everything.
Angus, your songs, like Mango Tree, have been described as upbeat and whimsical. And on the other hand, Julia, your songs can often be, as one critic said, more melancholy than a month of November Mondays, like this track called Wasted. Let's listen.
I don't know if I'll survive in this magical land behind your eyes. And there's all these funny little men, they're all asking me to dance and sing.
You know what, I mean, this was like, I think I wrote Wasted maybe 2.5 years ago or something, so it's been a long time, and to be honest, one night it's about this, and then another night it's about being wasted on someone where I feel like I have all this love to give and somebody isn't able to kind of take it on and experience it in a good way, and so sometimes it's about being wasted as a person on somebody, but you kind of don't know how to stop.
So I wonder, is it when you have two very distinct styles like the two of you have, and you really kept sort of separate identities in your own songs here, do you think that helps you when you're working together, or does it sometimes get in the way?
Even though we are kind of style-wise a bit different, there's like this bit of string that kind of will always be the same, and it always sort of stitch things up. Whether it be with bringing together the songs with harmonies and pretty little things to put on them, I think it works.
Well, let's listen to another song that's getting attention for its cynical view of how movies can distort a young girl's view of the world. It's called Hollywood.
She wouldn't make it to shore, the little mermaid. He would have married a whore from a wealthy family. After all, he wasn't royalty. Cinderella would have scrubbed those flowers.
day.
Julia, we can't help but ask about your vocal style. Very distinctive, very evocative. How did you find your voice?
When I was at school, I think people used to say I sounded weird when I sang, you know, like I'd sing the national anthem in the school assembly, and people would say I sound like a chipmunk or something, you know, but I think I was a little bit nervous about the way my voice sounded when I was in school, and then once I started traveling and staying at hostels and, you know, meeting people from all over the world, you just forget that anybody's voice is different or weird or, you know, or unique. You kind of just want to sing, and, you know, each time we perform, I feel like it gets easier and, yeah.
Angus, I think one thing when you listen to your songs that really strikes the listener is that there's a range of tempos. You shift gears mid-song. Is this something that's also a bit spontaneous?
Yeah, so a lot of our songs will have hills and we'll have like a valley, and then you get to the top of another hill and just, you know, bomb down it. So the timing will
fluctuate
for sure.
They brand you with the fire and push you into the sun. They want the free land to expire. They want everyone to be numb.
That's The Beast from Angus Stone. And Angus and Julia, we have to choose a song to go out on now. We don't want to start a sibling rivalry here, but we want you to make the call. So should it be one that features Angus or one that features Julia?
I have an idea. What would you...
Yeah, it's rocks, paper, scissors.
Okay. I'm sorry?
Rocks, paper, scissors.
You're doing rocks, paper, scissors, something that you do at a very young age to decide which song you're going to go out on.
You have to do this. I mean, we do this for everything, where we're going to eat for dinner or, you know, what song's going to start off the set. You know, you just rocks, paper, scissors, sort it out, it's done.
Okay. So what did we come up with?
Oh, sorry. Oh, here we go again.
Brother and sister duo Angus and Julia Stone. Their CD is called A Book Like This, which they are supporting with their first American tour. For more, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. Angus and Julia, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks
for having us.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Deborah Becker. Robin Young is back on Monday. Have a great weekend, and please join us again. Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.